Hey everyone, it's Noah,
Marissa,
and Tommy, and welcome to our podcast, Peace, Police, and Everything in Between. In early August, the three of us sat down on Zoom with Reverend Erwin Lee Trollinger of the White Plains Cavalry Baptist Church. We had an incredibly insightful conversation, covering everything from race relations to protests, and we even asked him some questions from the Colomy Youth Group.
Before we begin, we also want to give all our listeners a little bit of background on Reverend Trollinger. After growing up here in Greenburg, New York, he went on to graduate from Morris Brown College down in Atlanta. And in addition to being pastor, Reverend Trollinger is also president of the Ministers Fellowship Council right here in White Plains. And they're a community activist group that speaks to the needs of the community.
And on one final note, our conversation with the Reverend lasted almost an hour and a half. However, we get that most of you don't have 90 minutes to listen to a podcast, so we cut down our discussion a little bit. What you're about to hear is the best 45 minutes or so of our conversation with Reverend Erwin Lee Trollinger. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of Peace, Police, and Everything in Between.
Reverend Trollinger, we've really been looking forward to today. We've heard such great things about you from Rabbi Shira, and you're a respected and beloved pastor in your community. So thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with us today.
I'm honored to be here, and when you said first, that even makes me smile even better.
Well, we are just so thrilled to be able to speak with you today. So let's dive right in. In the past couple of months, there have been an incredible amount of protests, both nationally, but also locally here in White Plains. You helped organize one of them, Circle the City with Love, and many of our congregants attended this protest. And we're wondering if you found these stances against hatred to bring about any progress or change.
Okay. So, Noah, I no longer use the word change, because the word change simply means that you can move from one seat to the next seat. And the problem is we've been changing forever, then returning back to the same place where we've been. And so what has happened, I'm gonna just do it in a little bit nationally, but what's happened is we've been changing forever, but there has been no transformation. So I believe in transformation. So in 1619, that was a transformation when the first Africans were brought here to be slaves. So when the Circle of Love happened around the city of White Plains, I somewhat didn't get the meaning behind it. I was there because many congregations, especially the Jewish community, has been with the different things that I have done. And so I analyze stuff too much sometimes. And so I stood there and I watched. And the only thing that bothered me was just a little bit was that the person standing on either side of me that were white did not recognize my presence or say hi to me or anything like that. And so sometimes that bothers me in the context that we don't understand what we're really doing. But what really enthralled me, two things enthralled me about the circle of around the city, was one, you saw black, white, Latinos driving down, blowing their horns in solidarity with, they're saying, Black Lives Matter, and we're not going to be silent. That was powerful for me. The other thing that was powerful that I don't think I told Rabbi Shearer about was that over by the federal courthouse, when the Circle of Love was over, there were some agitators that came from without our community and began to assault two new police officers in the city of White Plains. And they were demanding that these two officers kneel. Two or three members of my church and other churches confronted these outsiders and said to them, y'all are not gonna do that in our community. Y'all not gonna stir up anything. Now, here goes the transformational. The police were now lined up, ready, okay? And because of the intervention of the community people, they were able to stand back, And they were ready. And that what the agitators wanted, to bring that violence nonsense into the city of White Plains. And see, I was born here. Unfortunately, I'm gonna tell my age. I was born here 61 years ago. And so I am not gonna allow any outside agitators to destroy the city of White Plains. We are unique. We are unique. We got our issues, but we are unique. And so what has occurred between now and then, the Circle of Love and Say Their Names March and Rally, is that the communities of faith are now talking together, and they are now, and we are all lending our voices together to share with our police commissioner, share with our mayor, share with our city council, and share with Westchester County government that we have one voice. One voice. And if you can just let me just say this real quick. In the midst of this time of transformation, for those who know who may not know, a lot of people who are not Black, I'm gonna put it that way, who are of the white hue, are now living in Harlem, now living in the Bronx, now are living in areas where African Americans live. And what Mr. Trump doesn't understand, and what white racists don't understand, that based upon whites living in Harlem, living in the Bronx, going to school, universities with Blacks and with Latinos, dating them, marrying them, being in relationships with them, it has caused a transformational power and energy to occur. Thus the reason why the white racist cannot grapple why are whites now marching with Black Lives Matter. It's because they have lived with us, they have seen the injustice front hand in front of their faces, they have dated and they have heard the hurt and the pain, or they have seen the hurt and the pain of an African-American man being arrested for nothing. The racist attacks in stores or prejudice, being followed around in a store just because you are a darker hue, you know? And so whites have now not seen it from afar, but have seen it up front. And so lastly, if you can think about, and if y'all have studied it, Bloody Sunday. Bloody Sunday with John Lewis transformed the civil rights movement. Why? For the first time, white America saw what Southern whites were doing to Blacks in the South. And that was a transformational moment, because now you have Jews, you have Episcopals, you have Quakers all coming to the South to stand with Dr. King. That was a transformational moment. And so George Floyd's death, hear me now, was nothing new in the Black community. But now it was something new to the white community, because you're now witnessing somebody having their knee on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 42 seconds. And when we did that at our rally, I ended up on both of my knees, because it is painful, painful to be on the ground with your knee for just 5 minutes, but it's just crazy. So we are now in a transformational moment in America. And not only in America, but it's happening in England, and it's happening in France as well.
Let's talk a little bit about police violence and race relations with law enforcement here in Westchester. Prior to our conversation today, we were doing some research, And we found a study regarding police violence here in Westchester by a data analyst that suggested in the past 25 years, there have been 24 instances of police shootings, and 16 of those 24, in 16 of those 24, the victims were Black, which is extraordinarily, an extraordinarily high rate. You just spoke about how white citizens are seeing racism in America for the first time. And our question is this: how prevalent has systemic racism been in Westchester for all these years? And how have you and your congregants been impacted by racism in local law enforcement?
The racism has been in Westchester for a long time, a long time. I repeat again, I went to schools here in Westchester. I went to Greenberg Central 7, as I said, but I also went to school in Mamaroneck. So racism has always played a part. Remember, y'all are one generation away, if I can say that right, from the civil rights movement. Y'all just one generation away. I'm a child of the civil rights movement. My dad, as I share with people, my dad hid racism from me and my brother. We did not know. We thought it was fun to go to the bathroom in the woods when we used to go down south to North Carolina to visit our grandmother. Here in Westchester, the segregationist idea and prejudice, just to say from Hartsdale to Fairview Greenberg, was evident. The racism between Fairview Greenberg, Mount Vernon, different areas of New Rochelle, and definitely Yonkers, was a totally different than Scarsdale. Believe it or not, I don't know if I'm just gonna say what's in my heart. So whenever I drive through Scarsdale, I automatically slow down. There is no way that I, as a 61-year-old man, am driving fast through Scarsdale. In Pelham, we grew up and we knew that Black people were not supposed to walk or drive in Pelham. Now, it's different now, but I still remember when we didn't go through Pelham. We didn't go through Scarsdale. All those things. The first time I went to Scarsdale High School was because I was a part of the all-county choir. And I felt some kind of way just going into the building because there was a sense of knowing that I may not be really welcome. So when you deal with, I think you said 24, Noah, there's more than 24. There's more than 24. At our rally that we had, Say Their Names, I think we counted at least over 50 or some from 1973, I think it is, up until now. And each police officer, save one, went to jail. Okay? And the deal is the police are always, the policing of the individual of doing unjust policing is always justified. Because there is a psychological idea that the person of color is wrong. All right? And that's based upon the individual police officer. And sometimes, yes, it is sometimes the police force itself. But for the city of White Plains and for the township of Greenberg, I would like to say there are probably individuals that are unjust, okay? But the enforcing agency of White Plains and Greenberg police are not, but there are individuals. And I want to be very clear with that. There's individuals because I have relatives and friends who are police. I have a gentleman, and I'm just going to say his name. His name is Chief McNerney. He's returning back as the commissioner of police or the chief of police for the town of Greenberg. He is the coolest brother. And he ain't a brother, but he's the coolest brother that there is, all right? Chief Castelli, who you're going to talk to from White Plains, he is the coolest brother, and he ain't a brother, but he's the coolest brother that there is, all right? So when you think with humanity instead of thinking in a race of white or race of Black, then you're able to do things better. But there are individuals, and I repeat, individuals who do unjust policing.
Let's hop off that question. You've been living in White Plains for a long time. Has racism changed in Westchester during your life? And if so, could you talk about how it has changed?
It has changed from more officers becoming police officers. It has changed based upon more elected officials being Black or Latino and women. It has changed in regards to our dialogue with each other and having positions of influence and power to change things. It has changed in regards to academics and education pursuits, in regards to understanding cultural and racial matters. It has changed. The very house that I live in, I live on Soundview, and in history, my cousin tells me that when they used to walk down Soundview Avenue to head to the golf course, I think it's Fenway or Fenimore, they would be arrested. As soon as they walk down the block, they would be arrested. I live here. I deliberately, after George Floyd and COVID-19, I deliberately speak to my neighbors and I make them speak. I make them say hi. I make them say good afternoon. I make them. And I do that deliberately. But it has changed because you and I are talking. It has changed because Temple Kolamim and Calvary Baptist Church went to Alabama together, okay? In Atlanta, okay? It has changed. Our children of Temple Kolamim and the children of Calvary Baptist Church, when we went to Alabama and to Atlanta, our first day, we call her Captain Abby, allowed everybody to stay in their silos. The next day, all the adults were up front and all the young people were in the back. By the end of that day, it was miraculous. I mean, it was totally miraculous. At the end of the trip, we were going to parties, we were going to graduations, we were going just to get together. One person became mama, other one became, I was passing the teeth to everybody, you know. And so, but it was wonderful. And we found out stuff about each other culturally, individually. And so it Westchester, once again, has its issues, but we're not as bad as other communities, okay? I say this much, we're not as bad as Rockland, where they're now still facing racial stupidity, okay? So right across the bridge, racism magnified. But here in White Plains, we got our issues, but we're in a better place.
We want to go into depth a little bit more about police budgeting. Based on our research, we found that here in White Plains, about 10% of the overall city budget, and that includes the school budget, goes towards funding the police department. New York City, which cut $1 billion from its police recently, only spends about 6-7% of their total budget on the police. Do you find this to be an appropriate amount of spending? And if not, how would you like to see the White Plains budget reinvested?
Okay, so I'm going to say to you that's out of my league to know in regards to budgetary matters in regards to policing. I am going to say to you that I believe that the budget within the policing department should include a vigorous and robust community policing program for all of the officers that are part of the City of White Plains Police Department. I believe that every officer should spend a year in community policing, no matter what their specialty is. So even if their specialty is in communication, I think that that person, before they take the job, the desk job, should have done at least a year of community policing. And I'm going to add a caveat to that. and then for them to be evaluated based upon their partner, senior partner, and the community in which they did the community policing with. Because just because you spent a year with me, don't mean you know me, okay? My cousin Paul was a police officer for the city of White Plains. And he shares with me when he used to do community policing, one of the white officers said, pointing towards the Winbrook projects, how do you make it in that jungle? And the officer was just ignorant. Just using the word jungle was it was biased, okay? There was a community officer that worked along with my cousin. He kept his gloves on, and we're talking about spring and summertime, kept his gloves on, never made true eye contact with the people of the community of Winbrook, and then said to my cousin, yo, you're gonna talk to your people, you're gonna talk to your man over there with that beer out? Okay, that's in his heart. So you guess what? He doesn't belong on our police department because he's already showed his bias, all right? And it may not happen with a ticket, but it may happen in some other kind of means of a way that will cause a person to be hurt by that specific police officer. So once again, I'm not too sure how to do the budget, but I know what I want to be in the budget. And that is at least the ability for a police officer to spend a year in community policing, and then to be evaluated by the supervisor and the community in which they serve, and let us know if that person really belongs on the streets and in the community of White Plains.
You mentioned your previous experiences with racism here in Westchester, and in preparation for this podcast, we were doing some research and saw that on your Facebook page, you've posted a political cartoon in which a white police officer asks a young black girl what she wants to be when she grows up. She simply responds, alive. Is this a danger that is felt by the black community, even here in Westchester, a county many would call progressive?
Yes, unfortunately. And that brings tears to my eyes. Yes. 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 We have the conversation with our black children. We have the conversation. I have the conversation. This thing. In the synagogue, you don't have to invite Jewish officers, police officers, to come to your synagogue to talk to you about being arrested. You don't have to. We have to. We want our children to come home. We want them to come home and not be hurt. And so we have to invite black police officers to come into our churches and our community centers to say to the black child, this is what you do. Every young man, there's two young men right now working from the White Plains Youth Bureau at my church right now for the summer. Every year, I think for the last 4 or 5 years, we have done this. Every year, I have a session with them. And because I'm the chaplain for the city of White Plains Public Safety, I give them my card. I give each one of the young men my card. And I say to them, if the police stop you and they arrest you, before you call your parents, tell them you want to talk to the chaplain of the police department. Just the police officer who's doing an unjust act will hear the fact that the chaplain for the public safety is going to be notified, will stop some unjust act, unjust policing for that kid. So yes, we still have to have that conversation with our children, especially boys.
We have some questions from members of our youth group that we want to ask, but before we get to those, we want to touch on what we as white Jews can do to help the black community, because at the end of the day, our whiteness is what is seen first, not our Jewishness. From what you've seen, what can white allies do to help people of color and the Black community?
Good. So it's nothing new. The present television, social media, and everything else would make you think that this is brand new. It's not brand new. Okay? W.E.B. Du Bois and the Jewish community created the NAACP. Okay? The highest award in the NAACP is named after a Jewish person. All right? Rabbi Weissman, I think his name. I think I may be wrong. But they worked with Dr. King. It's nothing new. Okay? And I always like to rip up the paper when people say, oh, this is brand new. There's a temple in Atlanta. It's called The Temple, right? And they were supporting Dr. King. And because they were supporting Dr. King, they set off a bomb in the Jewish temple. And that particular door was blown away, but they had another bomb. Well, let's put it this way. They set a bomb off, and that other bomb was to make the congregants in the Jewish temple to go out the main door. The main door bomb didn't blow up, okay? And what the Klan found out was that this Jewish temple, which is called The Temple, and it, I know it has another name connected to it, but it's called The Temple, was giving money to Dr. King, was giving money to the NAACP, you know? And so, yes, there are white Jews. If you haven't read it yet, the letter from Dr. King saying why we can't wait, he wrote that letter to the very synagogue that we visited in Alabama. The synagogue rabbi was so real. He was so real. And in this particular synagogue in Alabama, the Jewish rabbi there said, Dr. King, just wait. Just give it a little bit more time. And Dr. King pinned in the Alabama jail why we can't wait, okay? And we've been doing this for a long time. The problem is you've got radicals sometimes that don't know their history, okay? And so your white Jewishness standing next to me becomes volumes against anti-racism, anti-Semitism. Your ability of our children coming together and going on that trip stood as, what in the world is this, okay? You got a Baptist Black pastor and a woman rabbi together. What in the world is going on? Have we lost our minds? Yeah, this is what the world looks like.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute with more of our discussion with Reverend Chalmers.
Reverend, we want to shift the focus a little bit here. We sent out a survey recently to our high school youth group asking our peers to send in questions they might have for our various guests on this podcast. And one of the questions we received asked, and I'm quoting here, what internal problems inside the Black community itself need to be combated in order to fight against the effects of racism and racism itself? This would have come from a white high school student. And how do you respond to this sort of question?
Good question, because the question has been created based upon news, based upon CNN, NBC, Fox, and stuff like that. That's where that comes from. It would be the same question that you would ask an Irish community, a Jewish community, an Italian community, all right? What are the internal problems that needs to be combated? And so they may be looking at what I call fratricide, killing a brother. So let's go back to the Bible, Cain and Abel. It's right there, all right? Internal jealousy will always lead to criminal behavior, okay? It's not a racial, it's an inward, internalized situation that people need to deal with. So I would just flip, I would flip the question and say, what does humanity need to do to deal with the internal conflicts that we have on this? Now, there are historical ones, all right? And the questionnaire, the question person may not understood, there was something called the Willie Lynch letter. And the Willie Lynch letter was a letter that was written by a Jamaican plantation owner that was brought here to America to deal with their black problem. And Willie Lynch wrote a letter, and some people say it wasn't real, some people say it was real. I was taught that it was real. But Willie Lynch letter says he was on the boat going up the James River, and he smelled a stench. And the stench that he smelled was slaves or runaway slaves that will be was hanging from trees by the river. And he said, you are wasting your product. I'm putting this on my own words. You are wasting your commodity. What you do is you teach the slave to only trust you. You teach the older slave not to trust the old, and the older not to trust the younger, back vice versa. He says, teach them to that your law is the only law is to be founded. And I'm skipping over some stuff, but he says, if you do this, you will keep the Negro enslaved for over 300 years. Now, I'm not gonna ask y'all the question how long we've been out of slavery, but it's less than 152 years ago, okay? So if Willie Lynch is true, then that teaching and that indwelling may be still being acted out today, okay? Crazy for y'all to hear this, but crazy. My grandmama was a child slave, okay? She talks about Captain Jack, all right? But simultaneously, Grandma did not allow bad behavior to become a part of us. So I'm going back to the original question. So I think that's an internal human condition and not so much a racial issue, you know? So they can look at Chicago with all the killing, okay? They can look at, look at Brooklyn in the Bronx right now, okay? But we've got other conditions that are happening right now that allows a criminal to stay on the street right now, you know? And then it's all basivated upon institutional systemic racism that guarantees that's gonna stay in place. I give you an example. So when Miss Daughtry became the principal of White Plains High School, she said to me, and this is how you take care of racism and stuff like that. I was brought to the school to talk to her and her to talk to me, you know? And she said she has made sure that her team of administrators single out African-American students and Latino students that had the ability to take the AP courses and not to give them a choice. Because the system said, don't worry about them. She's saying, no, they have the ability. So that's how you do it. You take the bull by the horns and you make it go where it needs to go. Okay? Next question, I'm sorry.
On that same survey, we received a question that asked, quote, do you think some members of the black community are taking this too far? How do you respond to this sort of sentiment?
No, and I think the person doesn't understand, once again, institutional systemic racism that has been against the black American since 1619. Our Constitution, right? Our Constitution said that we were one time three-fifths of a human being, all right? We were property, all right? So are we taking it too far? No, we haven't really taken it far enough because, once again, Soundview Avenue. I live on Soundview Avenue. I repeat again. I live on Soundview Avenue. You know how many black people live on Soundview Avenue? Do you know how many grandfather laws that were placed in mortgages that said a person of color could not live in our area? I mean, that's crazy. Do you not understand that there are police departments that guarantee that African Americans will never, ever, ever work on those police departments? They are institutionally written, some right blunt, and then some things are just passed on from one generation to another generation. So here's the words that I know you know by, quote unquote, one of the greatest presidents in the United States. You ready? You ready for the words? You're sure now? All right. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Did Dr. King said that check came back insufficient funds? I'm just asking the question. You know, I'm just asking the question. If all men are created equal in the sight of their creator and endowed by the creator with inalienable rights, that what the Constitution says, then why did the black man have to be able to count how many pennies are in a jar in order to vote? Okay? Why did black people have to sit in the back of the bus? Why did black people have to go in the back door of the bus? Even better for you, ready? Just recently on Channel 2, why did a white woman with her child that had sneakers and shorts on, able to eat in a restaurant, and the maitre d' told a black woman with the same child, with her child that had sneakers and shorts on, that they could not eat there? And he says to her, how far do you live? Can't you get them to change? And she took the picture of the white couple. And there's nothing against the white couple. The white boy and the white woman, mother and son, that wasn't the problem. The problem was embedded inside of that maitre d'. See, that's what we got to look at. So when a person says, have we taken it too far? Okay, for real? I can't go in a restaurant with my boy because he got shorts on. When I look in the corner, that white person over there got shorts on. See, that's the stuff that stirs us up. That's the stuff that.
Right. So then what's the first step towards addressing this problem of racism? Is it through dialogue and conversation? Is it through education? How do we begin to tackle this?
So Noah, here's the deal. This is what I believe. This is what I believe. I believe that they call it the great sin of America, racism, right? Slavery, great sin of America. So if we're gonna be honest with it, maybe if what Abraham Lincoln promised, the 40 acres and the mule, because it's always dealing with economics, we wouldn't be in this place right now. I have a picture, and if you Barack, when we get finished this COVID nonsense, I'm gonna bring you this picture that I have. I got it from Savannah. It's called The 40 Acres and the Mule, and it's the picture of how Andrew Johnson got together with people of the Southerners to remove the promise of the 40 acres and the mule. So if President Lincoln and his cabinet, people around him, understood that for the African American to have equal rights, then he needed to have economic rights. But the Southerners understood to make him equal economically would be a danger, and there would be part equal. So I think we need to take a grand look, and I think White Plains would be a great experiment to have that conversation. I've talked to Rabbi Shira and Rabbi Les in regards to us having truth and reconciliation conversations within our churches and within our synagogues. If you don't know my pain, you don't understand. But simultaneously, Noah, because I am who I am, and I happen to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and turn on one of those crazy TV stations that are talking about history, and I learned that the Jewish plight here in America back in the 30s and the 40s was no different than the Latinos of today. There's no difference. Number 45 is doing no different than what's happening to the Jews when they first were escaping from Eastern Europe. There's no difference. And that's the thing that pisses me off, is because America continues doing the cycle. We just change the color or the religion of the individual. So we need to take a real good look about race. And the race is not just about, let me clear this, the race question is not just about black and white. Okay? Because Caribbeans came here and there was an issue. Jewish people came here, there was an issue. If the Italians be real, when they came here, there was a problem. The only person that never had a problem, and they should have had a problem, but now have a problem now, is the Native Americans. They're the only ones. They're the only ones. You and I live on their land. You and I, you know, we breathe the land, we breathe the air that they breathe, we look at trees that they grow. And where are they? You know? So we need to have a good conversation about race in America. And to do, if South Africa wisdom understood, then America should understand it as well. Mandela made sure that through the truth and reconciliation conversations and through Bishop Desmond Tutu, that South Africa then become the whites. In South Africa, blood was not spilt. Now, they may not like what happened, but they wasn't killed.
We know that we need to let you go soon, but before we do, we have one final question. There are many people who don't agree or agree completely with Black Lives Matter. What do you say to people who respond to the protests and Black Lives Matter movement by saying Blue Lives Matter and All Lives Matter? And how would you try to bridge the gap between these two movements?
Okay. So Tommy, believe it or not, when Black Lives Matter first started, I wasn't for Black Lives Matter. I was for All Lives Matter. And I got on a telephone conversation with a group of people and I said, no. And I was on a phone call with liberal whites and I was saying, no, progressive whites, no, not Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. And so they beat me up for about a half an hour. I still walked away from that conversation saying, all lives matter, right? Because I'm like, what are y'all talking about? I don't get it. I don't get it. And I am blacker than black, all right? If you could take a photo of my room, of this dining room, you know I'm black, all right? There's no doubt about it. I have strong black African-American pictures all over my house, all right? There's no doubt, you know? So I'm trying to figure out what they mean by Black Lives Matter. But it wasn't until, I repeat, it wasn't until George Floyd, I understood. When that officer publicly, without impunity, without fear, without knowing that there was going to be no reprisal towards him. He knew it. He already had 16 problems and he got away with them. He knew it. He had no problem putting his knee on that man's neck. Had no problem. And see, that officer is just one of thousands of officers that had no problem of choking out the brother in Staten Island, shooting a 12-year-old in the park, going into Eleanor Bumper's house and blowing her chest away. No problem with Michael Griffin. No problem just doing things to Black people because they knew they were going to be all right. Then it hit me. Black lives matter because you don't think they matter. And because you don't think they matter, then you make them less than the humanity in which God created them to be. So I can treat you a certain way and knowing that I can get away with it because that life doesn't matter. I woke up, Barack, a couple of days ago, and I watched BBC. I had a student that lived with me from Concordia College, and he said he didn't watch CNN or all the other, he just watched BBC because they don't do no commentary. So I watched the BBC and I was watching it, and they did the policing, the Black policing of Blacks in the United Kingdom. 100 officers have killed Black women and men in England, and not one officer has ever been indicted. Not one officer has ever went before a magistrate. Why? Because their lives don't matter. Okay? Once again, another story. This is White Plains. A young Black African-American young boy steals from the Galleria. They arrest him, processed him, and sent him to Valhalla. The very next day, a young white boy steals from the Galleria. The sergeant calls for his parents and tell his parents to pick him up, and he has a death ticket. What's up? Because the Black lives don't matter. It only matters to become, and this is the part that outside people don't understand. There is a systemic, racial, economic system connected to the incarceration of Black men. We are not the majority in this country, but we are the majority in prison. Why? Economically, we make the system prosper. I'm gonna give you a simple thing, ready? Toothpaste, toilet tissue, just the simple things. You know how much money companies are making on the incarceration of Black men and women in jail, in prison? Toothpaste, I'm talking about. Uniforms, I'm talking about. I may get in trouble with this, but Brock, you help a brother out, okay? Do you know that the hand sanitizers that the state is giving away are made by the prisoners in New York State prison? What in the name of the eternal God are we doing? I used to work for foster care. I used to work for an agency. And the beds that the kids slept on were made by prisoners. And these same prisoners used to be foster care kids. What are we doing? So it's not until we value all lives. That's why Black lives matter, because whatever you do to a Black life, it then will make you say, ooh, what about the Indians? What about the Native Americans? Y'all do know that the Navajo Indians have the highest rate of COVID-19 in the entire, and ain't nobody, you don't see that on CNN? And you know Fox ain't gonna talk about it. Okay? So, Black lives matter, because when Black lives matter, then all lives matter.
What a powerful note to end on. Reverend Trollinger, this was a truly captivating conversation, and we are so grateful to have you speak with us today. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences and perspective.
It has been my pleasure to speak with every one of you. Y'all all work on Rabbi Shira taking another trip to Alabama, okay? Y'all work on that. I know y'all can't go, but you know. sometime next year, we work on letting Kola Meme and Cowrie go back to the South again, all right?
All right.
That's great.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Reverend Irwin Lee Trollinger is a pastor at Calvary Baptist Church here in White Plains, and he and Rabbi Shira have collaborated on multiple occasions to bring our synagogue and his church together. You can follow him on Facebook or reach out to the Calvary Baptist Church directly to meet with him. And stay tuned, everyone. We'll be back soon for more of Peace, Police, and Everything.